This is Monocle Reads, and my guest today is Edward Brooke Hitching. He's the son of an antiquarian book dealer. He's an award-winning documentary director making films that examine the eccentric side of British life. He writes for the popular television programme QI, and following the enormous international success of his books The Phantom Atlas and The Golden Atlas, his stunning new work unveils some of the most beautiful maps and charts ever created during mankind's quest to map the skies above us. Edward, thank you so much for joining us here today with this beautiful, beautiful book, The Sky Atlas.
Thank you.
I want to talk about your beginnings because your father, Franklin Brooke Hitching, was a collector, in fact, of the largest and most comprehensive library of British exploration.
Yeah, well, he's a rare book dealer and he was going for about 40 years, but as any good dealer, he kept the best stuff for himself, you know. So because he worked from home, I grew up in this rare book shop where it's exactly as you can imagine. Every wall is jury-rigged with, you know, temporary shelves buckling with all these leather bindings, and but also maps, because we always forget that most maps came from books. So there was a lot hanging around, sitting around. And as a kid, the first thing you see are monsters and, you know, the cannibals and giants that weren't there. And then you start to look further and find other stories in them.
How wonderful. And so you were obviously a prolific reader from an early age.
Yes, I think being incredibly painfully shy and awkward helps that as well. but absolutely. And also because of his job and because of his amazing encyclopedic memory, whenever we had a question, you know, it was pre-Google, obviously, but whenever there's a question, it was, even if we're having a meal, go and get the encyclopedia, go and look it up right now. You know, it was go straight to the reference works to find any answer.
Yeah. Well, which makes sense of the fact that you also write for QI.
Yes, it was a weird kind of full circle because I loved watching it. I loved the way that they celebrate.
We should just explain what it is for non-British.
Sure. QI is kind of unique in a way. There's nothing like it in any other broadcast network in any other country, but it's essentially, it takes the most interesting facts and stories from history and science and throws them at comedians to make fun of, but also with the goal of trying to tell people a lot of things that they never knew about that were staring at them right in the face but were sort of lost in history.
Yeah.
And so I grew up watching it and loved the stories about, you know, the massive practical jokes that were played in London in the 18th century, and wrote a book called Fox Tossing, which was about forgotten sports. And that came to their attention. They used some of it. And then I was called in for an interview and sucked into it. And now I'm what's known as a QI elf, where you just research and write for them all day long.
Yeah. Could I just tell our listeners that I've never seen anybody less likely to be called an elf in terms of the fact that you must be plus 6 foot with a great big beard.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I suspect it's just a made-up job title, so they don't have to pay you any standard salary.
But coming up with those facts for that programme, I mean, on a weekly basis, that's a massive undertaking.
Well, it is in a way, but also the people that they hire, they find just think exactly like them all the time to the point of compulsion. So I have folders of things that you just end up, you're constantly looking, and it's a radar you can't turn off. So, I mean, I was ripping things out of the newspapers and stuffing them in my pockets, and it turns out everyone was doing that. And it was things that you never know if you might use. I mean, my favourite fact from a couple of years ago I noticed in the paper was that the head policeman in charge of UK knife crime was named Alfred Hitchcock. So little things like that might be useful. They're a bit funny, so you pocket them.
Absolutely. Now, this is not your first book. Tell me how you came to write in the first place.
I think it was because I would still, talking about this radar, you would notice, and I think it's very much in the sort of British sense of humour as well, and probably true worldwide, where when you notice a favourite little fact, you kind of keep it, and you become that annoying person when you're having a drink with a friend who rams, did you know this, you know? And it came from thinking I'd love to write a book. So I realised the best way for my brain was to work backwards. It wasn't to say, here's my subject, now how do I find all the research for it? It was, here's a bit of research I love. If this was in a book, what would that book be about? And that way you can find a bit more of a distinctive book. And so I loved the fact of fox tossing, this entertainment of the German aristocrats who would catapult foxes into the air as high as possible and lay a cushion of sawdust on the ground so they could have repeat tossings. But it was done with the same sort of civility as having a game of tennis before dinner, and people would perform it in wigs and their finery. And I just came across an illustration. We're talking about 1650, of these couples playing with a sort of strip of cloth between them. And whenever a fox would tread on it in this arena, it was their job to yank it taut and send it up into the air as high as possible. And obviously, it's incredibly cruel, but I think it's okay to talk and make fun of, because we're making fun of the people who played it and how ridiculous the whole thing is.
Octopus wrestling also features.
Yeah. Well, octopus wrestling, I didn't realise, was televised nationally in America as an annual competition in the 1960s, as late as the 1960s. So that was the point, to find things again that were always kind of staring us in the face. I mean, I love the sport of ski ballet, which everyone seems to have forgotten, but was televised as part of, it was an Olympic hopeful in 2000. That's how late it was happening. And it's a cross between ice dancing with all the sequins and the music and the fireworks, but on skis. People would do it on slopes and they'd sort of vault and something. And I love, you can go onto YouTube and search for ski ballet. I'd recommend the routine of a gentleman named Hermann Reitberger, who does this incredibly emotive performance and then sort of somersaults over his poles. It's astonishing to watch.
Quite extraordinary. Now, you've also written a book called The Phantom Atlas.
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, The Phantom Atlas was part of this idea of doing three books about maps that would encompass, basically divide the great stories into three sections. So The Phantom Atlas was about all the places that were drawn, painted on maps, that never existed. So it was a world purely as we imagined it, but believed it to be true. So not just famous stories like El Dorado and Atlantis, but the mountains of Kong, which were drawn for over 60 years from around 1800, stretching across the entirety of the African continent as this vast, uncrossable wall that simply didn't exist. And it was based purely on a miscalculation by a British mapmaker. And so it was looking at how these phantoms, these geographic misbeliefs, lasted on maps for so long, and asking, why do we never question a map? It has such authority. Is it because it's told from a kind of godly perspective? It's all laid out as fact. And so it's fascinating to break down the maps and look at the stories that are hidden in their lines. So following that was the Golden Atlas, which was taking the history of exploration, but using maps to show how far we went and the stories and the blood that filled these maps and made these lines expand across the paper. And now the Sky Atlas is saying, well, let's leave all this sort of blood and guts and slavery and turn our eyes to the heavens and ask, what did people 17,000 years ago think when they looked upwards? What kind of myths and imaginative stories did they concoct to explain things that even we today, some of which we still can't explain?
It's filled with absolutely beautiful visuals. Yeah. I mean, the drawings, the paintings, the maps are just exquisite. Describe the shape of the book, if you will. It's in four sections.
Yes, well, and the actual book itself is designed to be a kind of mix between a coffee table book with that beauty, but also something you can read with interest all the way through. And so I thought the way to divide over 17,000 years of cosmic history was to basically start with sort of prehistoric stargazing and everything sort of before the invention of writing systems, which obviously we can only speculate, but over history we've had very intelligent people speculating. And it's fascinating to compare, for example, the drawings in the Lascaux Caves, which were made 17,000 years ago, and find markings of constellations like the Pleiades, which would have been the most brightest in the sky, and how they match perfectly. So we know that's what they were drawing, but we've no idea what they would have made of it. We can only speculate from the other incredibly cosmic, imaginative paintings on the walls. Mm. And then we move to when the ancient Greeks and other sort of natural philosophers and astronomers are trying to make more practical sense, more analytical decryption of this cosmic theatre. And that's where you get the most amazing theories that at the time were viewed as perfectly sensible. So, for example, my favourite is the crystal spheres of the ancient Greeks, which, you talk to people with an Oxbridge education, like, oh, yeah, the crystal spheres. They know it all perfectly well. I was never taught it at school. I've been so obsessed with the story because it's such an amazing image. And the idea is basically this, that if you imagine a set of Russian nesting dolls, but now picture them as transparent as glass, and they're spheres, not dolls, but they're still inside each other, and each one is turning at a different speed. So it's this amazing clockwork mechanism. But the ancient Greeks believed that each planet was embedded in the shell of each sphere. So the larger ones were obviously the planets further away. And this explained their kind of circular patterns. Because, of course, you would extrapolate what you understood from the ground. If something is carried regularly, it's because something is physically carrying it. So right at the center of this clockwork universe is us on the ground and Earth staring up at this sort of glass machinations. And what's most astonishing, and talking about longevity, is, you know, the Greeks were talking about this hundreds of years BC. It lasted to Ptolemy and Alexandria in the second AD. And then we still find it, even Copernicus, you know, the title of his revolutionary pamphlet, the title is On the Revolutions of the Heavenly Spheres. So it's still held then in the 16th century. It lasts for so long because it's the only answer they had. And when we look back on it, we thought they were out of their minds. But it's perfectly logical.
Completely.
So it's so exciting.
Yeah. Let's talk about the medieval era.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things is to look at the effect of not just the transmission of knowledge from Alexandria, because obviously with the sort of Islamic takeover of Alexandria, Muslim scholars took on the custody of this great wealth of knowledge. And eventually, with the expansion into Spain, the Iberian Peninsula, these works reach Europe. They're rediscovered by European scholars from about the 10th century. And so suddenly from this, it's a problematic term, but from this dark age of a lack of scientific understanding and scholarship, European scholars start to rediscover. They discover the astrolabe, the way of measuring the inclinations of stars, and they discover all these ancient Greek and Islamic refined texts. And along with that, we also, at the same time, we get astrology and the huge impact that astrology had on medicine. So, for example, you know, medieval surgeons at one point had to, by law, consult astrological charts to decide where and when and how to perform surgery. Because we have in the book, there's an illustration of something called the Zodiac Man, which is this figure laid out on the table and a chart of how every constellation affects a different part of your body. So if someone came in complaining of a sore wrist, well, depending on which time of year and when that person was born, you'd have to factor in the Sagittarius constellation into your treatment of that person.
That's extraordinary.
It's amazing, yeah.
This is so rich with wonderful stories, and it feels criminal to kind of skip through them at this rate. Yeah. But I want to pick up on the third part of the book, which is about the scientific sky. What particularly stands out for you in that?
I think it's looking at the gradual progression of how we understood exactly from a kind of mechanical aspect now of what was going on. Because one of my favourite things is, and what I was lucky enough to do in the book, is provide illustrations so you believe me when I tell you these stories. Because the great scientists talk about, for example, Descartes, who we sort of think of more as a sort of, you know, cigarette-smoking philosopher or someone idly talking. But his famous quote of, "I think, therefore I am," was basically his way of resetting everything he knew about the world, about the cosmos. He said, let's forget, let's jettison everything. Let's start with me. Well, I know I exist because I'm thinking. I know that God exists because it's too perfect a concept for my mortal brain, my flawed brain, to have come up with. So we've got me, we've got God. And then he looked eventually at the universe and he thought, I'm going to forget everything that astronomers for the last few thousand years have said, and I'm going to apply my own thinking. And he came up with what was the opposite of a vacuum. They didn't have the idea of a vacuum then, but he came up with the plenum. And the idea was that the universe, it's such a strange idea, the universe is essentially completely full of matter. Outer space is just full. And space and matter are made of the same things, except that matter can move through space. Now, that might sound incredibly confusing, but the best way of imagining it, and what I try and do in the book is break down each one with a simple analogy, because it helps me, is if you imagine a glass full of water and you drop an ice cube into it, and you spin the ice cube, as the ice cube melts, it becomes one with the water, but at the same time, you have the shape of its spinning, of its energy, still there, and yet everything is made of the same thing. And that's how Descartes saw the universe. He pictured these huge vortices of matter spinning around the bigger lumps of matter, which were the planets, would spin further away, a bit like how a heavy boat can't turn suddenly a turn in the river. It would just hit the bank. That's how planets were sort of spinning out because they were heavier, caught in the vortex of the sun. So it's so interesting to take these figures that you sort of have a vague understanding of and you hear quotes of them and suddenly get a glimpse inside their minds and inside their imaginations. And it just fires your own up endlessly.
Absolutely. And as I say, all accompanied by these beautiful, beautiful illustrations. Mm. The final section is all about the modern sky. And again, I think the only picture of a black hole.
Yes. Well, that was so exciting because I had one day left to send the Sky Atlas to the printers. And the day before it was due, it was announced this amazing achievement that a photograph of a black hole had been managed to have been taken. And like a lot of NASA photography, they release it to the public domain because, you know, it's for the good of mankind. And so I was so lucky to get it into the book. And as far as I know, it's the first book to ever have a photograph of a black hole, which is just incredibly exciting. But it's something we never thought we'd see. And while this book sort of wraps up the stage of where we are now and what we have to look forward to in the future, like the James Webb telescope, which we will be saying as commonly as we say the Hubble telescope in 2 years.
What is the James Webb
telescope? It's this giant, when you see a photo of it, it looks futuristic. It's this giant sort of golden honeycomb mirror that will hopefully allow us to have, well, it will have an incredibly enhanced acuity and resolution, and will hopefully allow us to see back to the very earliest stages of the universe. Obviously, those are the furthest away, and so that's when we need the best eyes. But the state of astrophotography is so incredible. It uses something called gravitational lensing, where we can see around stars by using their gravity. The light from something behind it is warped by the gravity of something in front of it. And light is obviously how we see the thing that's emanating it. So if a light is bending around, we can grab that light and see where it came from. So the future is incredibly exciting. You know, just the other day, we've had studies published suggesting that the universe is not flat, as we always believed it to be, racing outwards in this sort of expanding disk. It might be spherical, which means theoretically, if you traveled forever, you would eventually end up back where you came from because you'd just be riding this spherical curve, which is revolutionary and was always thought of as nonsense. And now we have incredible evidence for it. So the future of space and the future of everything we are going to see and our descendants are going to see when they look at the sky is always changing and always becoming clearer and more colourful.
It's beautifully told story, beautifully presented,
thank
and you.
You
talk about it incredibly well.
Thank you.
Edward, thank you so much for coming in. It's called The Sky Atlas. It's by Edward Brooke Hitching and it's published by Simon & Schuster. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Do subscribe to the show to get each new episode sent directly to your inbox. With thanks to producer Nora Hull, I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.